Your symptoms suggest that it may have shifted. I don't mean to scare you, but you can't put this off. Do you understand? You could risk paralysis.
Oh, I said in a small voice.
All I mean to say, he added more gently, is that at a certain point, the risk of doing nothing begins to outweigh the risk of surgery. I think we may be nearing that point.
16. Thursday, October 17th, 2013. The picture that ran on the front page of the Journal Constitution was arresting. The photographer had screeched up half an hour late, ranting about traffic and bad directions. He whipped out his camera and positioned me hurriedly on Mrs. Dorminey's lawn, swearing the whole time. But his timing was exquisite. The portrait was saturated with golden light. My lips stood out, a slash of scarlet across pale skin. The angle of the shot made me appear smaller than I am, fragile even. The effect was haunting even before you got to the caption. Caroline Cashin, standing in front of the house where she lived with her parents until she was 3 years old. On the inside pages, they ran the X-ray image, cropped to emphasize the bullet glowing inside my neck. It was surreal, reading Leland's account of how I had returned to Atlanta. He told the story chronologically, and he got the facts more or less correct. Yet the article felt somehow disconnected from me. I wondered if this is how celebrities feel when they see glossy profiles of themselves. There was nothing per se to quibble with. It just read like an account of someone else's life. In any case, Leland Brett had been right. The article immediately produced results. 2 phone calls. The first rang through the hotel switchboard to the phone beside my bed.
Hello, Caroline? Said a deep voice.
Yes.
This is Ethan Sinclair. I was a friend of your father's.
Oh, hi.
Forgive me for calling so early. I'm staring at your picture in this morning's paper. What a shock.
It's okay. But can I ask how you got this number? I was irritated with Leland. He had no business telling people where I was staying, not without checking first with me. It turned out, though, that Sinclair had figured it out on his own.
Lucky guess. It says in the article that you granted an interview over breakfast at the St. Regis. That's not a place that AJC reporters typically frequent, I wouldn't think. So it seemed reasonable to assume that's where you must be staying.
Ah, I see.
I always wondered what had happened to you. The police wouldn't tell friends of the family anything. It's a relief to know everything worked out for you.
Thank you. So how did you know Boone Smith?
We were tennis buddies. Same ALTA team. That's the league here.
I didn't know he played.
Oh, sure. Boone was pretty good. He played varsity at Chapel Hill. We used to whack a ball around in the evenings after work. We ended up doubles partners for a while.
And you knew Sadie Rawson, too?
Of course. Great couple. Both so proud of you. Listen, I'd love to meet you, if you've got the time. I don't know how long you're planning to stay in Atlanta.
I'm flying back to Washington today, actually.
Glad I caught you, then. I live just over in Brookhaven. How about breakfast? I could be at your hotel in an hour.
Ethan Sinclair crossed the room as if he owned it. Tall and powerfully built, he had the lithe body of a man who still put in regular hours on the tennis court. Sinclair wore a dark suit and gleaming cufflinks. He fit right in with the expense account crowd now polishing off breakfast in the St. Regis.
Thank you so much for seeing me.
He took both my hands in his huge ones and gave them a squeeze before taking his seat.
I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw the article this morning. Usually I don't see the paper until I get to the gym. Betsy, my wife, she reads the copy that comes to the house. But she was up early today, walking the dog, and the front page was already spread out on the kitchen counter when I came downstairs. It took my breath away.
He unfolded a white linen napkin across his lap. I saw now that he was older than he'd appeared from a distance. Salt-and-pepper hair and a patrician face, tanned and deeply lined. He must have been 65, maybe older. He sat studying me, too.
You're very much like her.
I nodded. So I've been told.
You really are. You've got her smile. She was tinier, though. Petite.
His eyes roamed over me, but not in a salacious Lelandesque way. This did not feel sexual.
It's jarring, seeing your face. Trying to reconcile it, you know, with Sadie Rawson's. I didn't know her all that well, and it's been a long, long time. But the resemblance is unmistakable.
The waiter bustled up.
Good morning, sir, madam.
He winked at me.
What may I bring you this morning? Your favorite sweet potato pancakes?
God, they were good at these high-end hotels. This poor man must have served dozens of people yesterday, and here he remembered my order. No, thank you, just the yogurt and fruit today. And, maybe a side of bacon.
Very good. He bowed. And for you, sir, might I suggest the lobster frittata? Served with fingerling potatoes, fresh horseradish.
Sinclair, who had not so much as glanced at the menu, waved him off.
Two eggs, please, scrambled. With a whole wheat bagel, toasted, no butter. Sriracha sauce on the side. Sriracha sauce. They'll have it. Thanks so much.
Sinclair turned back to me and smiled.
Gives a bit of kick to the eggs.
Ah, I'll have to try it sometime.
It's come to me, now that we're talking food, why you look familiar. You do look like your mother, no question, but also a bit like that woman with the cooking show. The English woman looks Italian, always licking frosting off her fingers.
Nigella Lawson.
That's the one.
I'm trying to remember exactly what she looks like, whether I should feel flattered or insulted.
Oh, feel flattered. The camera doesn't zoom in and linger on all that frosting licking for nothing. Betsy adores her show. But I gather you're in a different line of work than the lovely Nigella. A professor, was it? French lit?
That's right, up in Washington. And you? Are you a pilot?
A pilot? He looked confused. Oh, you mean because Boone was? No, that's not how we met. I'm an attorney. Securities claims, broker-dealer arbitrations, that sort of thing. The litigation side of things, meaning lawsuits rather than corporate deals.
I know what litigators do. My dad and brother are both lawyers.
Your dad?
He shot me a strange look. My dad, meaning the man who raised me, Thomas Cashin.
Of course, of course. The article made it sound as though you don't remember much about Boone and Sadie Rawson.
Nothing at all, unfortunately.
I suppose you were so young.
I thought being back here might jog some memories, seeing my old house and all that.
And has it worked?
Not so far. The newspaper archives had an old photograph of my parents, and seeing it was jarring, to use your word. But I can't say I would have recognized them.
I might have a few pictures of your dad kicking around the house. I'll have a nose through the old albums this weekend. Maybe some of us posing in our tennis whites. I'll mail them to you if I find any.
That's kind of you.
And the bullet,
he lowered his voice.
Did you really not know it was there?
I shook my head.
You poor girl.
He patted my hand across the white tablecloth. What a thing to learn after all this time. That X-ray is unbelievable. There's no way they can operate and cut it out.
The doctors aren't sure.
Well, if you decide you want another opinion, probably the best neurosurgeon in the Southeast is an old friend. Mike's over at Emory now. I'd be happy to put you two in touch.
Thank you.
Just say the word. It's no trouble. You don't want to mess around with someone who's not top-notch. But I assume you're talking with good doctors up in Washington?
Not really, I hedged. I've been too caught up with coming down here and processing everything that's happened to give the bullet much thought. Ethan Sinclair seemed like a nice man, but I didn't feel like discussing my medical symptoms or my private life with him. It was exhausting enough trying to keep up with them myself. Sinclair insisted on picking up the check. As he walked me out, he pressed his business card into my palm and made me promise to keep in touch.
I don't blog or do Facebook or any of that nonsense, but if you ever need anything, anything at all, call me. My cell number is on there. It would be an honor to help out the daughter of Boone Smith.
I took the elevator back upstairs to pack. I'd booked an afternoon flight from Atlanta to Washington. I needed to get home to meet the neurosurgeon tomorrow, and meanwhile, Madame Aubuchon had emailed from the French department to inquire whether I felt inclined to teach my regular Friday morning class. Her tone was polite, but there was no mistaking that the correct answer would be yes. I wrote back to confirm that I would indeed be there. I was looking forward to getting home, to resuming my normal life. I missed my campus routine, my hours in the library, and I was finished here. I had not achieved closure, whatever that meant. But it had been strangely comforting to sit at breakfast this morning, spooning up yogurt and listening to Mr. Sinclair rave about my birth father's backhand. Apparently Boone had employed a weird grip, one hand so high up the racket it practically rested on the strings. Sinclair swore that it resembled a drunk man playing air guitar. But it had produced a ferocious topspin that left their opponents spitting with frustration every time. I loved that detail. Not because I gave a damn about Boone's tennis grip, but because I could glimpse him as a real person. I'd felt the same way when Cheryl Rooney shared Sadie Rawson's talent for scorching cookies. It was a relief to meet people who had known the Smiths. Known them as funny, flawed, normal people, and not just as victims of a tragedy. I started brainstorming whether there might be some way to honor my birth family, perhaps a donation to a charity they might have supported. If any sort of inheritance ever did turn up, I could direct it there. Cheryl might know whether Sadie Rawson had embraced any particular cause. It cheered me to have a plan. These last 7 days had been wretched, so painful, but perhaps I was through the worst. I began to hum as I threw the last sweater into my suitcase. Sweet emotion. Aerosmith is hard to beat when you need perking up. Steven Tyler's screech is too infectious. When had that song first come out? Mid-70s, I was pretty sure. The radio stations would have played it nonstop. Boone and Sadie Rawson had probably owned the album on 8-track tape. They might have played it at parties, Boone playing air guitar for real, Sadie Rawson dancing so hard the gold gypsy hoops flew off her ears. I stood grinning at the thought. Then my cell phone rang. This time it was Leland Brett. People had been calling the newsroom in response to the story about me.
"Some real nut jobs out there," reported Leland. "Not that that comes as any surprise after 40 years in the news business. One lady says she's a psychic. She can help you contact your parents beyond the grave.
Huh? That would be useful.
Yeah. So would winning the lottery, but that's not going to happen either, is it? But listen, this one guy says his name is Beamer Beasley.
Beamer Beasley?
Now, don't laugh, sweetheart. It's not such an unusual name for Georgia. His middle name's probably Bubba. Anyway, he says he's a cop. Says he worked homicides for the Atlanta PD back in 79.
Why did he call?
He says he worked your mama and daddy's case. I had Jessica check him out. He sounds legit.
And did he seem to know anything that might be relevant?
I don't know. He wants to speak to you personally. Asked me to pass the message along.
I glanced at the clock. I had a couple hours before I needed to leave for the airport. I'd been planning to return a few phone calls, then go for a walk. Maybe I could meet him.
Sure, why not? Tell you what, how about you meet him here at the newspaper? Nice neutral territory for you both. I could find you a quiet meeting room to use, and afterward, I'll take you out for lunch.
Absolutely not. Not least because I'll be racing straight to the airport to catch my flight.
Meet him here anyway.
Leland sounded disappointed.
Maybe he'll agree to an interview after you and he are done talking. There might be material there for a follow-up story.
An hour later, Beamer Beasley and I were seated across from each other in a small conference room. He was African-American, older, perhaps in his 70s, with grizzled hair cropped close against his skull. Time had thickened him around the middle and left him stooped. But his eyes were clear and gray and intelligent. Beamer Beasley had a stillness about him. You sensed that he'd seen an awful lot in his years on this earth, and that there wasn't much left in the repertoire of human depravity that might faze him.
I came here to say two things, he said, after Leland had finally been persuaded to leave us alone and shut the door behind him.
I'm listening.
The first is that I'm sorry for failing you. You deserved justice after what happened to you and your family. You deserved that. And we tried hard, but we failed you, and I failed you.
I'm sure you tried your best. He held up his hand to hush me.
Please, let me finish. When you work law enforcement for as long as I have, you learn to forget most of the wickedness you come across. You learn to leave it at the office, put it out of your mind. Only way you can keep on getting up in the morning. But some cases, you carry them here.
He pressed his hand over his heart.
I've been carrying yours for a long time. I always hoped to get the chance to tell you that. I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry and ask for your forgiveness.
A tear sprang to my eye. I was genuinely touched. Thank you. It was brave of you to come here and say that.
Not brave at all. Wish I'd been able to say it 30 years ago.
Well, I appreciate your saying it now. We sat in silence for a moment, then I leaned forward. May I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
I did wonder how a case like that was never solved. A double homicide and a child shot. It's such a dramatic crime. But the newspaper made it sound like you guys just gave up. He flinched. I don't mean to sound rude.
No, you've got every right to ask. We didn't give up. But you have to understand what was going on in the city.
He frowned and shifted in his seat.
You ever hear of a man named Mark Tettleman?
I shook my head.
I expect his name is lost to the history books. He was a doctor, visiting Atlanta from out of town for a convention. He got shot down and killed by robbers trying to steal his wallet. This was a few months before your parents died.
I waited.
I was on duty that night. We were interviewing his wife down at Grady Hospital when the surgeon came out and told her he'd died. It was their wedding anniversary. 11 years married. That's why they'd left the hotel and gone out to dinner that night.
Beasley swung his head from side to side sadly.
Mark Tettleman's death caused a big old scandal because he was well off and white, and everybody worried the publicity would hurt the city's convention business. It did, too. After that, everybody decided they'd rather go to Houston or Miami. But what stuck in my head was that Tettleman was the 112th homicide that year in Atlanta. The 112th. And he died in June, Miss Cashin. 112 people killed, and we weren't even into the hot part of summer yet. Do you understand what I'm telling you? We're dealing with a new murder nearly every day.
I remembered what Jessica Yao had said. Somebody told me Atlanta had the worst murder rate of any city in America.
That's right. Not even Detroit could keep up. Nobody knew why. And then, when you thought things couldn't get worse, little boys started turning up, strangled.
The child murders.
Yes, ma'am. On top of everything else, we had a genuine serial killer running around the city, murdering black kids and throwing their bodies in the woods or in the river. You can't imagine. Folks were scared to let their kids ride bikes down their own street. And the politicians, they were blaming us. The old governor came out and said we cops ought to show less jawbone and more backbone. His exact words. I never forgot 'em.
Anger flashed across Beasley's gray eyes.
Worst of it was, Governor Sanders was right. You had black cops, not all of us, but some, whispering that maybe it was the Klan, the KKK, that was killing the kids. You had a lot of white cops who just up and quit the force. And then, to top it off, the courts went and ordered a hiring freeze. Said the police department was racist. The hiring policies were racist, and we needed to stop hiring new cops altogether for a while. You can guess how much that helped things.
He puffed the air out of his cheeks and leaned back.
I'm going on too long. I don't imagine you care much about the sorry history of the Atlanta PD, but you asked me why we let your family's case drop. And that's the only way I know how to answer you.
You're saying, basically, that it was a bad time for the city. Too many murders to investigate and not enough of you to do it.
In our defense, we did try. Your case got under a lot of people's skin. Not just mine. A young couple gunned down with their daughter watching. You didn't see that every day, not even back in 1979. And I hate to say it, but you all were white, and that meant folks paid more attention. But there wasn't much to go on. No murder weapon, no witnesses.
Except me.
Except you. But I gather you don't remember anything, and I don't think you were old enough to understand what you'd seen back then either.
I hesitated. I wasn't sure I wanted to know the answer to my next question, but I might not get the chance to ask again. Would you describe for me exactly what happened that day, as best as you all were able to reconstruct it? I would like to know the details of how they died.
You sure about that?
I think so.
Once you get an image in your mind, it can be hard to shake it back out. The way your parents died wasn't pretty. You know the basics of what happened, don't you? Might be best to leave it at that.
Again, I hesitated, then made up my mind. I'd like to know. The gray eyes searched mine.
All right, then. I expected you might ask. I read through the old incident report before I drove over to refresh my memory.
I'd love to get a copy of that report, if possible.
All right. I don't have it on me, but I can do that.
I bit my lip, then prompted him. I know from the newspaper account that they died in the kitchen, and that it was late afternoon.
That's right. Neighbors heard a commotion and called it in. There was no sign of forced entry. The first responders had to kick in the door. They found you three together on the floor.
But they were... My parents were already dead when police got there.
They would have died instantly. The nature of their wounds suggested that, and the autopsy results were consistent. They wouldn't have suffered.
It's so strange, I murmured. Why I lived and they didn't. I mean, if we were all shot at once, three bullets from the same gun, you'd think it would have gone the other way since I was smaller and weaker. Was it just the location of their wounds? Beasley looked at me.
I told you when we started that I wanted to say two things.
You did. That's right.
We're treading close to the second one now.
A look of grim determination settled on his face.
You sure you want to do this?
Yes.
Then I'm going to walk you through the sequence of what we think happened. Let me get through it, and then I'll answer your questions as best I can.
Sure, okay.
We believe your father was shot first. That's based on the way he was found positioned on the floor. And it makes sense. If you think about a man trying to defend his family, he would have tried to put himself between the gun and your mother and you. So the shooter would have hit him first.
I shuddered, took a breath to steady myself, then nodded at Beasley to go on.
Your father, as you may know, was shot in the head. Shot at close range, 10 feet or less. The bullet passed right through. It came out the back of his head and lodged in the wood of the door frame. But the shooter dug it out and took it with him. The wood was splintered and broken from where he'd hacked at it.
I frowned. That doesn't sound like something a random burglar would do.
What do you mean?
The old newspaper articles, the ones that Leland Brett wrote. I motioned at the closed door of the conference room and the newsroom beyond. He quoted a cop who thought the shootings were an accident, a burglary gone wrong. But wouldn't a burglar have panicked and run?
And not stuck around to dig a bullet out of a wooden door frame?
Beasley completed my thought.
You're right. It's odd. But people are odd. They do all kinds of things that don't make sense.
At any rate, you never recovered the bullet.
We never did.
And my mother, she was shot in the chest.
She was, he said carefully. She was trying to protect you, too. She had pushed you down behind her.
Tears sprang again to my eyes. I tried and failed to keep my voice steady. So you're saying, what, that the guy shot her and then pushed her aside to get to me? What kind of person does that? What kind of a person shoots two people and then aims a third bullet at a defenseless 3-year-old child?
No, Ms. Cashin.
Beasley leaned forward and folded my trembling hands into his.
There was no third bullet. The bullet that killed your mama passed right through her, too.
I don't understand.
The reason you didn't die was that the bullet was going slower by the time it got to you. Your mama did protect you. She slowed it down.
I blinked at him. It took a moment for the full, sickening significance of what he was saying to hit home. Then my hands flew to my neck, and I began to claw. 17. In the wild, a mother tiger will fight to the death to defend her young. She will knock down an animal 4 times her size, will attack and kill even a male tiger. When she senses a threat to her cubs, she growls. Then she flattens her ears and bares her canines, the corners of her open mouth pulled back. That snarl is the last thing a would-be predator ever sees. Human mothers share the instinct. Most of us know at some raw, unspoken level that our mothers would fight like a tigress to protect us, would give their lives to save our own. But it is one thing to believe in the abstract that your mother would take a bullet for you. It is quite another to learn that she has literally done so. Beasley had to pin my arms to my sides to prevent me from opening my skin. He must have been twice my age, but he was still strong, and I was no match for him. I thrashed for a minute, then went limp. The bullet throbbed, a hot white pulse through my neck and shoulders. It defied belief. The same bullet. The very same piece of metal had passed through Sadie Rawson's breast, through her heart, on its way to me. "I want to rip it out," I whispered.
"I know."
Instead, Beasley made me focus on taking shallow, jagged breaths. He held me upright. Gradually, my breathing slowed. When I could speak, I asked, "Was that the second thing you wanted to tell me? Please say there isn't more. I don't think I can take it."
"That's the worst of it."
He extended a handkerchief and I blew my nose. "Thank you. I'm sorry. Sorry for going crazy like that."
"No need to apologize."
"Just that every time I think I've heard the worst of it, there's some new revelation that knocks me flat. The bullet that's in my neck is the same one that killed my mother? That's, I don't even know what it is."
"It's gruesome."
"Gruesome, yes. That it certainly is." I shivered. Pain was shooting down my wrist now, too. I folded my right arm tight across my chest and cradled it, hunched over like a broken bird.
"Miss Cashin."
He was looking at me sideways.
"I have to ask, has coming back here triggered any memories? Going back to look at your old house, or hearing me describe the details of what happened that day?"
"No, nothing. I'd hoped it might."
"Probably wouldn't have been admissible anyway. In court, I mean, if you'd remembered anything relevant. But I had to ask."
A thought occurred to me. "Were you one of the detectives who questioned me after I was shot?"
"Yes."
His voice was neutral, quiet.
"You were heartbreaking. Tiny little girl, all bandaged up. The doctors didn't want us anywhere near you, but we had our jobs to do. I didn't talk to you myself. They brought in a child psychiatrist, a lady trained to deal with kids who've experienced trauma. But they allowed a couple of us to watch from the corner."
"And what did I say?"
"Oh, you wouldn't talk. You were barely more than a baby, barely talking as it was. I never heard you say a word. But we hoped you might remember what the guy looked like. The shrink showed you photographs, and you pointed at one. She shuffled them, and you pointed at it again.
Same one. But 2 days later, when we could organize a lineup, he wouldn't ID him. Wouldn't point to anybody at all.
I thought about this. How did you know what pictures to show me? I mean, were they random, or did you have a suspect?
We had a few. We questioned the man who used to clean your parents' gutters. He couldn't keep his story straight about where he'd been that afternoon. Turned out he'd spent it blind drunk in a bar. Didn't want his wife to know.
Beasley shrugged.
More promising, there was a guy who'd done a few burglaries around your neighborhood. We picked him up when he tried to offload silverware and jewelry he'd lifted from a house on Cantrell Road.
The random burglar theory.
Exactly. And there was jewelry missing. Apparently, your mama had a particular necklace she favored that she never took off. It was gone. Never did turn up. But there was nothing to indicate the Cantrell Road guy ever set foot inside your house.
I shook my head in confusion. So whose picture was it that I picked out?
We also had. We had a statement from a neighbor directing us towards someone.
What neighbor? The Rooneys? Beasley screwed up his face in concentration.
Can't say I remember the name. She was a teacher. Lived next door.
That's Cheryl Rooney. I met her yesterday.
He looked wary. And what did she say?
Nothing about a suspect. She just talked about what the neighborhood used to look like, what my mom was like. She gave me an old pair of Sadie Rawson's earrings.
Uh-huh. Well, she was under the impression, I'm sorry if this comes as yet another shock, but she was under the impression that your mama had been having an affair, and she thought this other man was someone we should question. So we did, and we thought we might be on to something, because that's the picture you pointed at. His picture. But we couldn't make it stick.
I tried to take in this latest piece of information. Was it true? Was she having an affair?
Who knows?
Beasley shrugged.
He denied it, and there wasn't any evidence. So maybe it was true, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe the neighbor just didn't like your mama. Or maybe she was jealous. Women can be vindictive. No offense.
The newspaper said police arrested a suspect and let him go. Was that?
No, we never arrested anybody. We questioned him, and then we let him go. He had an alibi, airtight. And we had no physical evidence, not a scrap. We couldn't hold him.
In the parking lot outside the newspaper building, a chilly rain was falling. I pulled my jacket over my head and dashed for the Mazda. Wet and panting, I climbed in and flicked on the heat and the windshield wipers. They were old and made a squeaky, scraping sound each time they shuddered across the glass. Every 2 seconds, they cleared a glimpse of the gray world outside. Then the rain sluiced down to blur it again. I forced myself to concentrate on the wipers, to use them as a metronome. Steady, deep breath. Everything will be okay. I willed even the throb in my neck to obey the commanding rhythm. Scrape, throb, breathe. Don't think. Scrape, throb, breathe. I'm not sure how long I sat like that, staring at the half-fogged windows. I knew I needed to step on it if I was to make it to the airport with any hope of catching my flight. But I couldn't muster the energy to shift the car into drive. When the throb had quieted to a manageable level of pain, I twisted around in my seatbelt, reached for my phone, and dialed Martin.
Sis, how are you? Where are you? Still in Atlanta?
His voice sounded so normal, so unburdened it seemed to come from a different world.
Yes, I said dully.
Still in Atlanta.
Would you do me a favor and phone Mom? She's completely freaked out. Says you didn't call yesterday.
Sure, I will. It's been crazy down here.
Seriously, sis, call her. And listen, can I call you right back? I've got an investor on the other line. We're trying to close on a deal this week.
Martin. I press the phone closer to my ear.
Hang up on him and talk to me.
Sure, okay, but he's in Abu Dhabi. We're recapitalizing his properties in Manhattan. I'm talking hundreds of millions in office, flex.
You know, I have no idea what you're talking about. Please. My voice cracked. I need you to tell me what to do.
Martin is too much the classic oldest child to resist such a plea. He has always exhibited an almost parental sense of responsibility toward Tony and me. It seems to coexist easily alongside the pleasure he takes in teasing and tormenting us, and in Tony's case, actually giving him a physical pounding from time to time. I could picture him now, pulling his shoulders back, preparing to launch into full older brother, let me tell you how to fix your problem mode. Except that my current problems were not easily fixed. He listened in silence as I told him about Beamer Beasley and everything that I had learned.
Wow, he muttered when I had finished.
Yeah.
That's insane about the bullet in your neck being the same one that...
He broke off.
It's hideous, actually. It's... Christ, I don't even know what it is.
That's what I said when I found out.
But aren't you thinking that maybe you could have the bullet removed? You're going to see a surgeon, right?
I'm supposed to do that tomorrow. Will set it up.
Who's Will?
My regular doctor.
On a first-name basis, are we? Asked Martin suspiciously. How old is he?
I don't know. 40-ish.
Married?
Martin, for God's sake.
I repeat, married?
I don't think so.
I knew it. Next, you're going to tell me he wears black skinny jeans and that he chain-smokes gitans. Where do you find these guys?
Very funny. If you're trying to cheer me up, it won't work.
Not at all. Farthest thing from my mind. I am curious, though, whether Dr. Sprockets has taken you techno dancing yet.
Despite myself, I smiled. Trust me, he's not the skinny jeans type.
Or should I call him Dieter?
Martin, he drives a Jeep and he listens to Johnny Cash.
Aha! So you've been in his car? Front seat or back?
Will you listen? I exploded. I'm not dating him. I'm trying to have a serious conversation with you about a serious subject.
Fine. Want to know what I think you should do?
I'm beginning to regret asking, but yes.
Go ahead. I think you should get your butt on a plane back up here and go see that surgeon. The one Dr. Sprockets has hooked you up with. Personally, I would have done that before jetting off to Atlanta, but whatever. Go see him and schedule the surgery to get the bullet removed. But before you do any of that, for Christ's sake, call Mom.
I sighed. I know. It's just, I thought I was finished down here, and suddenly it feels like I'm not. Think about it. I've found out more about my parents since I woke up this morning than I have in the last 34 years combined.
Your birth parents.
My what?
Your birth parents, not your parents, because that would be Mom and Dad.
Of course, I said more gently. My birth parents. That's what I meant. But that kind of underscores my point. My whole life, I've thought that we had this idyllic, perfect childhood.
We did, basically.
No, you did. I think we can agree that mine turns out to have been quite a bit darker than that.
But hang on, how does it...
Could you shut up and listen for a minute without getting defensive?
I'm saying I always believed I had the perfect childhood in Washington, and it turns out that that was a mirage. And then I come down here to Atlanta, and I guess I constructed another version. That my birth parents were this storybook couple, gorgeous and in love, and tragically cut down in their youth. And now it emerges that maybe that wasn't true either.
Why not? Because maybe Sadie Rawson had an affair?
Yes.
But who cares if she did? Who cares if she wasn't an angel? I mean, not to sound harsh, but does it matter at this point?
He was right, but I was still upset. I struggled to find the words to make him understand. The cop, Beasley, he said Sadie Rawson pushed me down behind her, that it looked like she had tried to protect me.
Well, it sounds like she did.
Right. But what if it was from a threat that she brought into our home? Don't you see, Martin?
Not really.
The neighbor told police that she was cheating on my dad and that they should question the man she was sleeping with. And then, apparently, I pointed at a picture of the same guy. The same guy. And if it's true, and if it's in any way related to the shooting, then sure, she protected me, I said bitterly. Kind of like a mother hawk protecting her young from a live snake that she herself has dropped into the nest. 18. Cheryl Rooney looked surprised to find me on her doorstep again. After hanging up with Martin, I had checked my watch and calculated that I might yet make my flight if I floored it to the airport. That would be the sensible thing to do. My brother was right. I needed to get home, get my neck seen to, and forget about the past. But I couldn't do it. Not yet. Instead, I backed out of the newspaper parking lot, pointed the car toward Cheryl's house, and stepped on the gas. From the car, I made two phone calls to Washington. The first was to my mother, to reassure her that I was still alive. The second was to Will Zartman, to let him know I wouldn't be on the flight this afternoon after all. His response was uncharacteristically subdued. He didn't protest, and he didn't ask why. He merely inquired into how I was feeling and whether I needed a refill on painkillers. He hung up before I'd even said goodbye. Strange. I wondered whether I'd misread his intentions. The way he had touched my hair the other day, and that comment about my body. I'd been sure he was building up to something, but today he could not have sounded less interested. Cheryl Rooney, by contrast, lit up when she saw me. "Caroline!" She pulled me in out of the rain. "Come in, come in. You'll get soaked out there." She stood back and inspected me. "I wasn't expecting to see you again. I thought you'd already left town. Let me put on a pot of coffee. Oh, or no. You're partial to tea, aren't you?" "Cheryl, leave the drinks for a minute. Come here and sit down." I led her back into the living room where she'd received me yesterday. "Did you see the article in this morning's paper?" She nodded. "Apparently a lot of people did. And one of them told me some things about Sadie Rawson that I didn't know. Some not very nice things. He told me that before she died, she might have been having an affair."
Cheryl stiffened.
"Who told you that?"
"One of the cops who investigated the murders. He said you were the source for that. That you were the one who told police about it.
Is that true?"
She was looking strangely at me.
"Does it matter? Why would that even come up now?"
"Because I was asking him about suspects."
"So is it true?"
She pursed her lips in apparent annoyance.
"Well, I can't think why a police officer would want to dredge all this up. Why would he want to tarnish a daughter's memory of her mother? You want to know what's true. Sadie Rawson was beautiful. She was funny. She loved you.
Everything I told you is all true. I really think that's all you need to know, Caroline.
I reached forward and touched her knee. Thank you for trying to be kind. But I'd rather know the whole story, all of it, even the bad parts. Cheryl stared into the corner of the room for a long moment.
Oh, I don't know what the right thing is to do, she murmured.
Look, you said yourself, none of this probably matters now. But since I'm here, and since I'm asking, I think I deserve an answer. Several seconds passed. Then Cheryl began to speak.
I didn't know your mother before she was married. I knew her type, though, and so do you. You only had to talk to her for 5 minutes before you guessed that she'd been the prom queen and the prettiest girl in her sorority, and that a dozen boys had dropped down to one knee and begged her to marry them before she picked your daddy. She had that way about her, you know, a mystique.
I nodded.
I was flattered that she wanted to be my friend, if you want to know the truth. I mean, it was only because we were next-door neighbors. Her best friends were still her sorority sisters. They were mostly up in North Carolina, though, and she was down here and stuck home with a baby.
And so this other man, I interrupted, hoping to hurry her along.
But it was like she couldn't stop, said Cheryl, ignoring me. She was so used to having men buzzing around her, like flies drawn to honey. The four of us, Rick and me and your parents, we would go to a party together and she would be dancing and flirting and carrying on. She wasn't happy unless every man in the room fell a tiny bit in love with her by the end of the night. Scarlett O'Hara had nothing on your mother, I tell you that.
She was young.
She was old enough to have a husband and a child. She was old enough to know better.
Cheryl heaved a deep breath.
Sadie Rawson did love you. She really did. She was sweet when she was pregnant with you. She wanted a girl. She wasn't much better at sewing than she was at baking, God knows, but she stitched together dresses for the two of you. Red and white gingham with fancy red bows at the waist. Mother-daughter dresses, so you two could be all matchy-matchy. Before she even knew whether you would be a boy or a girl, she just knew she wanted a girl, and Sadie Rawson always got what she wanted.
The bitterness in Cheryl's voice was now unmistakable.
When you know, she bounced right back, got her figure back in about 4 seconds flat. And I don't know exactly when, but sometime after that, somewhere around the time you learned to walk, she started carrying on with Tank.
Tank?
He was a football star in high school, notorious for rolling the other team like a tank. I guess the nickname stuck.
Cheryl rolled her eyes.
He and Sadie Rawson used to flirt like crazy. I'm sure it drove Tank's wife nuts. But then, after a while, I noticed Sadie Rawson was ignoring him. We'd all go out and she wouldn't talk to him. Wouldn't even make eye contact with him.
And so you assumed something must have happened between them.
She seemed to think it was a game, spat Cheryl. That having an affair was a great big funny game. She didn't seem to get that what she was doing was wrong, that she was hurting people.
So this was the sour undercurrent I had sensed. Cheryl had watched my mother cheating and had disapproved. Maybe she felt protective of my father and me. Or maybe she was jealous, as Beamer Beasley had suggested.
But are you sure something happened? Something more than flirting? I pressed.
Oh, honey. They were in love. They were discreet enough, but sometimes I'd see his car parked in your driveway. He'd pull all the way up so you couldn't see the car from the street. But my upstairs window looked right out over your parents' backyard.
I pictured Cheryl scowling out her window at the driveway next door, tried not to picture what must have been going on inside Sadie Rawson's bedroom, with me asleep in my crib down the hall. Do you have a photo of him? I want to see what he looked like. Maybe somewhere, Cheryl shrugged. Our old albums are boxed up in the storage unit. I keep meaning to clean it out. I pressed my finger to my lips, thinking. What about Boone? Did he know?
I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think so. I never saw the car except on nights when your daddy was flying overnight somewhere. And Sadie Rawson kept her mouth zipped shut. She didn't talk about it, not even to me. Not until after she ended it.
Ended it? You mean ended the affair? Cheryl nodded yes.
She eventually came to her senses, decided she wanted to try to make things work with your daddy. I'll give her that.
Relief washed over me. I couldn't tell you why it mattered, but it did. To know that at the end my mother might have been faithful to Boone. To believe that maybe at the end they had been happy. Then Cheryl spoke again.
She was terrified. That's why she talked to me. Scared out of her mind.
Scared of what?
Of Tank. He wanted them to run away together. Wanted her to leave Boone, and he was going to leave his wife, and they would run away. But Sadie Rawson wouldn't do it. She could be so damn stubborn, your mother, when she broke things off for good. He went crazy.
Crazy how? Threatening to tell Boone?
Oh, worse than that. He hit her. He was a big guy, as the name suggests.
He hit her?
That's when she finally told me everything. She came over and sat down in my kitchen and cried and cried. She didn't know what to do. I told her she'd made her bed, literally.
A sad laugh escaped Cheryl's lips.
She made her bed, and now she had to lie in it.
But she was scared. I felt sick. I've thought about this so many times, whether there was something I could have done, somebody I should have told. But I don't think even Sadie Rawson believed he would really harm her. I frowned in confusion. You said he hit her. It sounds like he harmed her plenty.
He said he would kill her,
Cheryl whispered.
Tank said he would kill her before he would lose her. And then she was dead.
Tears began to fall down Cheryl's cheeks.
She was dead,
and I knew he had kept his word. 19. There is a ring road that circles Atlanta. It functions like the Beltway in Washington, separating the core of the city from its surrounding suburbs. In Atlanta, this road is called I-285. Locals refer to it as the perimeter. I had learned this at the Hertz desk 3 days ago, when I picked up my rental car, and the agent instructed me to avoid the perimeter like the plague at rush hour.
Unfriggin' believable that a 16-lane highway can get backed up, but it does, he'd advised. Better to take Georgia 400. Otherwise, you'll be stuck in mind-numbing traffic forever, wishing you could slit your wrists.
I had made a mental note and kept away. But as I drove away from Cheryl Rooney's house, I noticed a sign marking an I-285 entrance ramp, and on a whim, I took it. Frankly, mind-numbing traffic sounded appealing. Mind-numbing anything, for that matter. I was desperate not to think about what I'd just heard. I steered down the ramp and into the stream of cars, which, sure enough, was barely crawling. By the time I had completed a full circle around the perimeter, 2 hours in the late afternoon traffic, my mind began to clear. I decided I'd had enough. Enough with chasing phantoms. I could try to find this tank, confront him, demand to know what had happened that day back in 1979. But what good would it do? It wouldn't bring back Boone and Sadie Rawson. What had happened to them, what had happened to me, was unspeakable. It would be a long time before I got over the shock of seeing Sadie Rawson's face in that photograph. But you can feel only so much sorrow for a person whom you physically resemble but can't actually remember. Enough. It was time to go home. Dusk was falling. I had nearly finished another loop around the city. The car needed gas and I needed a drink. Out of habit, I headed back to the St. Regis. I had handed in my room key this morning to discover that Ethan Sinclair had picked up the tab for my entire stay. 3 nights. Plus, I cringed to think of him seeing this, the gargantuan bill for my room service cheeseburger frenzy. He must have circled back and handed the manager his credit card after we'd finished breakfast together this morning. He had left a handwritten note at the front desk.
Caroline, such a pleasure to meet you. Hope you don't mind my doing this. Betsy and I would love to take you to dinner if you ever find yourself in Atlanta again. I like to think that somehow Boone is watching over you, and that he knows his friends are looking after his baby girl. Yours truly, Ethan.
What a nice man. No wonder Boone had liked him. And thanks to his thoughtfulness, this trip had now cost me a fraction of what I had budgeted. I could afford to stay put tonight, catch my breath, and fly back to Washington first thing tomorrow. Soon I was stepping out of the Mazda and onto the stone driveway of the hotel. The elegant lobby was hushed, only a few people milling around, a piano tinkling somewhere out of sight. A familiar-looking bellhop scurried over to take my suitcase. I was headed toward the front desk when I froze. Did a double take. Felt my heart skip. Standing there, beside the elevators, was Will Zartman. We stared at each other for a long moment. Then Will held up a hand and waved. I crossed the lobby to where he stood. What are you doing here?
Hey, Caroline. Nice to see you, too.
He smiled, waited. But I wasn't in the mood for routine pleasantries. What are you doing here? I demanded again.
I was worried. You sounded awful on the phone.
Did I? Well, it's been a hell of a day. I didn't think... You didn't sound very interested when I called.
I was interested.
His voice was both determined and a little shy.
I was starting to think the only way to get you back to Washington was if I came down and dragged you back myself.
If you came down and dragged me back. And so you just went and jumped on a plane this afternoon?
You need to keep your appointment with the surgeon tomorrow, Caroline. Either that or let me connect you with one down here.
I stared at him, trying to take this in. How did you find me?